Chapter 17. The Templar. Hesperides. Tracking. They sat across from one another in the troop bay of one of the grounded Thunderhawks, alone after the first captain had barked an order to clear the ship so that they might have some privacy. The act seemed unusual to Garrow. Knowing the character of Dorne's stone men as he did, the legionary expected to be clapped in irons and subjected to arrest. Instead, Sigismund reached forward with Garrow's sword and scabbard, briefly confiscated by his subordinates, and laid the weapon on the deck between them. Garrow made no move to pick it up. His steady gaze held. "Did your Jean father order that?" He tilted his head in the direction of the ruined settlement. Sigismund's jaw clenched. "You know better than to say such a thing, Death Guard." "I have not been a Death Guard for quite some time," he replied. "The insurrection has changed many things. Perhaps your master's countenance is among them."
"I would choose to believe you are testing me," growled the Imperial Fist, "and poorly at that. The alternative is that you impugn the honour of the Seventh Legion, and were that to be so, it would go badly for you."
He pulled a device from a pouch at his waist, and Garrow saw it was a handheld Auspex unit. Sigismund tossed it to him, and he caught it easily.
"Listen," he told him.
Garrow turned the device over in his hands and found that the display screen showed a blinking rune to indicate it carried an audio recording in its memory. He pressed the button to replay the data file, and for a few brief moments the interior of the troop bay echoed with sounds of screaming and the voices of the dead. He listened to a man whose words were distorted with terror and feedback as he shouted into a vox pickup, desperate for someone to hear him, pleading for rescuers to come and save them. The accent was thick, and several of the words were from Afric dialects Garrow did not know, but the intent of the message was clear. It had been sent as the killing was in progress, as whatever force had come to murder the sanctuary had done its swift and merciless work. The recording cut off suddenly in the middle of a panicked shout.
"That was picked up on one of the common distress wavelengths," Sigismund explained. "We came to investigate."
"And your men thought I was the cause?" The first captain looked away.
"They reacted with poor judgment. Inaction has made them lax. They'll be chastised for acting without thinking."
Garrow realized that that was the closest he would get to any kind of an apology. Sigismund went on.
"What are you doing, battle captain? I have heard tell that you were at large, but why here, and why today?"
"Both our missions have altered," Garrow offered at length, "since the Eisenstein."
Sigismund nodded.
"You are Malkador's attack dog now, with armor that bears no sigil or livery. What is it that you are called? A knight errant?"
Garrow bristled at the offhand description of his status. "There is more to it than that."
"Where the sigilite is concerned, I have no doubt,"
Sigismund shot back.
"He would build a scheme with 1,000 players just to fetch him a cup of Amasek."
He leaned back and cocked his head.
"But I wager he did not send you to this place. Have you escaped his employ, Garrow?"
He nodded at the sword.
"You've left your nameless armor behind. If not for that weapon, I might ask if you had decided to give up the warrior's calling in hopes of a monastic life."
"I am here on a duty of my own, not by Malkador's orders," Garrow allowed. "I came to the sanctuary looking for information."
"About this?"
Sigismund reached for something and threw a wad of burned devotional papers on the deck, across the sheathed sword. Garrow ignored the question and kept his eyes fixed on the Imperial Fist.
"If I am Malkador's attack dog," he began, "one might say that you are Lord Dorne's. What was the name they gave you? The Templar, I recall?"
He gestured at the black cross on Sigismund's tabard.
"We both serve masters who seek to safeguard Terra and the Imperium."
For the first time, Sigismund's expression shifted, and Garrow saw a cold twist of humorless amusement on his lips.
"We are alike. Is that what you wish me to believe? You, a man who moves in shadows under the aspect of a ghost, are the same as I. Who stands for all to see, his duty clear as daybreak?"
The first captain's blunt truth cut Garrow more deeply than he expected.
"I did not choose the path I am on," he said tersely. "But we each fight the battle we have, not the battle we want."
His words faded as a suspicion crystallized, one that had been gnawing at him since the moment the Imperial Fists had arrived.
"You answered that distress call?"
"Aye."
Garrow leaned forward.
"You did. Captain Sigismund, commander of the First Company of the Imperial Fists, defender of this planet. You brought 2 dropships and a detachment of space marines into the desert for... what? The sake of a garbled message from some luckless civilian? There was nothing in that signal to warrant the deployment of such a force. Why not leave it to the local garrison instead?"
"We were passing through the area. It seemed expedient."
Garrow snorted.
"You do not lie well, cousin."
He pieced the facts together.
"The Imperial Fists were already monitoring this place. It is the only explanation that fits. My question is, for what reason?"
He saw a flicker of doubt in Sigismund's eyes and chased it down.
"Or am I mistaken? These warriors are not here at Lord Dorne's behest. They are here at yours."
Sigismund's face turned to stone, and it was then Garrow knew he was right.
"When I first met you," said the other captain, after a long moment, "I thought you a deluded fool. We pulled you and your fellow refugees from that frozen hulk, dead in space, and you stood before my gene father with stories about treachery and betrayal. I knew there were lies. Knew it. Until the very moment that Remembrancer Ollerton showed us her memories."
Sigismund shook his head.
"Empress Blood, Garrow. Do you realize what damage you wrought with your flight?"
"More than you can know. I took no pleasure in it," Garrow said quietly, and he felt the shadow of that moment pass over him once again.
It was not untrue to say that Nathaniel carried resentment for the burden that had been forced on him at Istvan.
"I curse Horus Lupercal every day for forcing me to make the choices I did."
The Templar looked away.
"The woman, Keela. You know what she is."
It wasn't a question. Garrow frowned.
"I..."
He halted, unable to frame his thoughts.
"We have spoken. I was illuminated by her insights."
He nodded in the direction of the burned-out settlement.
"I hope to find her here so we might talk again."
"She spoke to me,"
said Sigismund, and Garrow could tell that the admission was a hard one for the Imperial Fist to voice.
"Told me things. Showed me things."
He nodded.
"Yes, she has a way about her."
Garrow thought back on the counsel Keela had given him when he felt lost and rudderless, that she had become connected to some greater actuality, perhaps some fragment of the Emperor's manifested will, had never been in doubt. It came as no surprise to him that the so-called saint shared that counsel with others. He looked at Sigismund with fresh eyes, assimilating this new truth. It was as if he had given the First Captain permission to unburden himself. As he went on, hesitantly at first, Sigismund leaned close, in the manner of a brother sharing a confidence. He described how he had crossed paths with Keela aboard the Phalanx, and spoke of the futures she had laid out before him. One, to perish forgotten and alone under an alien sun. The other, to stand at Dorne's side when the inevitable invasion of Terra took place. Sigismund told him of his own grave choice, to go back on his Primarch's command to lead a chastisement force against Horus and beg a different posting, closer to home. Suddenly, Garrow understood why the Imperial Fist had ordered his men to leave them aboard the Thunderhawk. He did not want anyone else to hear this, to glimpse what some might see as a fissure of weakness in the man's otherwise granite-hard exterior. If the knight-errant ever spoke of what was said here, he knew he would be ignored and derided by Sigismund's brethren. As Garrow had become Malkador's agent in acts of preparation and retribution, so Sigismund had been tasked by Dorne along the same lines. The First Captain purged the solar system of Horus's spies wherever he could find them, and Garrow had frequently seen the results of his work from the sidelines as their missions crossed one another, always in parallel but never in unity. But there had come a moment where Sigismund could no longer keep his secrets from his gene father. That bleak mien Garrow had seen pass over the Imperial Fist's face before returned, and he saw it for what it was, great sorrow, and regret. Sigismund confessed to Dorn, and in turn his Primarch tore him down for it. The Master of the Seventh Legion decried Keeler as a charlatan trading in worthless religionist dogma, and reprimanded his son for allowing himself to be swayed by her. Garrow said nothing. Inwardly, he thought it was Dorn who did not see clearly. It had been clear to him at their first meeting when he revealed Horus's perfidy, and then again when he stole aboard the Phalanx on a mission to recruit one of the Fist's psykers. The latter sortie had ultimately failed, but on both occasions Garrow had known that for all his greatness, Rogel Dorn's rigidity of mind was a flaw. As much as stone may endure, he thought, it cannot bend, and so it may shatter. He only had to look Sigismund in the eye to see that truth reflected in the Templar's troubled thoughts.
"Keeler showed me a vision of arcane horrors," Sigismund concluded, "and I have since seen them with my own eyes. You have too?"
"Aye," Garrow nodded grimly.
"That I have." "Then you know her gift is not worthless."
It was a hard admission for the Imperial Fist to make, to suggest that his liege lord could be so mistaken. He took a long breath.
"I do not profess to know how all this is supposed to work, but I know the woman is important. With that in mind, I have watched over her from a distance, as best I could. I have used the assets of my legion and the Imperial Court to track her movements."
He shook his head.
"She and her devotees have not made it simple. There are many gaps, many unknowns. It speaks to a great network of believers in existence, far larger than any of us suspected."
Garrow pressed him for more. "But you knew she would be here, or was here, at the sanctuary?"
"Yes. As you surmised, I had the location monitored. One of many, in fact. When the call for help came, so did I."
Sigismund paused.
"Garrow, you know how Horus's turncoats operate. Like the Hydra of myth, we sever one head and two more rise to take its place. For all that we root out, others still lurk unseen. I believe that Keeler may perish at their hands if we do not prevent it.
The killings here, they show that the arch-traitor is getting close to her." He nodded.
"She must be protected."
The Templar rose to his feet.
"But I have reached the limits of my agency. Tonight, I exceeded authority to come out here, and Dorn will learn of it. He will be displeased once again. You see that the Imperial Fists do not have the freedoms of Malkador's knights errant. I can go no further with this."
He fixed Garrow with a hard look.
"But you can. It is clear to me now that you are the only option."
Sigismund reached down and took the Auspex unit from Garrow's hand and raised it to his face, allowing a retinal aura reader to scan his eye.
"Identify me. X-load storage stack. Code word iconoclast. Unlock," he told it.
The device chimed, and he passed it back. Where before the unit's memory had been almost empty, there were now dozens of other files revealed. Surveillance intercepts, intelligence files, and more.
"What am I looking at?" said Garrow.
"All that I have gleaned about Euphrates Keeler's movements over the past months. You may be able to fill in the gaps. I believe it will help you to predict where she will go next."
"You are trusting me with this?" said Garrow warily.
"We have to keep her safe, Nathaniel," Sigismund replied. "As much as I wish to, I can go no further. So, the duty falls to you."
Some of the chilly fire of his earlier manner returned to his voice, and his next words were very much a warning.
"Do not fail."
The Imperial Fists called in a cohort of servitors to catalogue and then bury the dead, but Garrow was gone before the first of them arrived. It took him the better part of a day to walk back across the scraplands, and the passage gave him the time he needed to digest the import of his conversation with the Templar. As he walked, he pored over the content of the Auspex, using hypnagogics to flash-read the vital data as a starving man might gorge himself on a banquet. As he expected from an Imperial Fist, Sigismund's record-keeping was precise and bereft of anything but cold fact. The files tracked dozens of reports of illegal Lectitio Divinitatis gatherings, partial scans from sightings of women who matched Keeler's description, and dozens of other vectors, collating them into something that resembled a pattern. He found strings of intelligence that connected with his own research, including the same blind lead that months before had sent him to the Riga platform on what turned out to be a fool's errand. Although the journey to Riga led Garrow to other things, and eventually to the uncovering of a secret the Sigillite had wanted to keep from him, the legionary found no traces of Keeler's passage. She moved from place to place, slipping in and out of hive cities and metroplexes, space stations and orbital plates, never once being captured, despite the iron grip the Imperium kept on the throne world and its satellites. What did that suggest? Garrow wondered. Did Keeler's preternatural abilities enable her to weave through the security net that grew ever tighter as the War Master's threat encroached? Or was the truth more prosaic than that? Was it that her association of followers was so large that those devoted to her simply looked away as she passed? How far does the word of the Lectitio Divinitatis reach? Garrow had no answer for that question, and it troubled him. The Imperium of Man was just that, and it had gone so far to stamp out the falsehood of religion, imposing secularity wherever its shadow fell. But what if that was impossible? What if there was something in the nature of humankind that meant they always needed something greater than themselves to believe in? He scowled and displaced the nagging thought. For the moment, he cared not for what other men might think, feel, or believe. He only knew what Nathaniel Garrow felt, and that was loss.
"Where is this leading me?" he asked the air.
The winds gave him no answer. Garrow returned to the data, moving from past records to present ones. According to Sigismund's sources, there were rumours that Keeler had visited the sanctuary less than 4 days ago, the closest Garrow had been to her in a long time. There were a dozen other possible locations that the saint could have journeyed to on the next step of her endless pilgrimage, but he quickly considered and discarded all but one. The guess was part instinct, part calculation. Hesperides. Garrow halted and looked up into the night sky, craning his neck until he found a particular shadow off towards the southeastern horizon. From here, it was little more than a blue-black smudge against a rare starry evening, low against the sallow glow of Luna. The orbital plate was one of the older Airtropolis platforms, and he recalled it was an Insula Minoris that served Terra as a dioxide refinery and tertiary shipping hub. It was an ideal place upon which to deliver a sermon. Much of the population were transients, system crews, and unskilled labourers who moved as needed on contract indentures to Venus, Mercury, and the teeming Nullgrav workyards of the Belt. The kind of men and women, Garrow reasoned, who would have empty lives overshadowed by the insurrection. The kind of people who, if so enticed by the Lectitio Divinitatis, could carry word of it to all corners of the solar system. A day later, Garrow dropped from the wheel well of an automated cargo barge and fell 100 feet to a landing deck on the western arc of the floating city. At a distance, Hesperides' plate recalled the shape and form of a great pipe organ, buoyant on a cushion of dirty clouds and wreathed in grey haze. Up close, the imagined form gave way to a less attractive reality, a great convoluted knot of tarnished tubes and gargantuan bell mouths that resembled the fatal collision of 1,000 giant brass instruments crushed into a clump by the hand of a mad god. Nowhere on Hesperides could one find silence. Every passage and walkway was walled in by lines of rattling, echoing pipes that hummed and gurgled with chemical reaction. Deep in the bowels of the platform, engines that had operated for centuries sucked in polluted air and fractioned it into its component elements, desperately trying to salvage some breath of purity from the wounded atmosphere of the planet. The constant noise made it difficult for Garrow to extend his battle senses to the full, and he mentally recalibrated the parameters of his actions. A place like this would make it harder to see an enemy coming, and the confined byways were perfect territory for ambushes, choke points, and murder boxes. Pulling his hood down and his robes close, Garrow made sure his sword was hidden where none could see it, and ventured deeper into the endless range of narrow alleyways. Hesperides had never been designed to be a city. It was a glorified atmosphere processor with a few support modules bolted on, but someone had neglected to reveal that to the people who lived there. Humanity crammed itself into every nook and cranny of the structure, with ramshackle hovels built around spaces between the great brass tubes that snaked this way and that. Parts of the makeshift city were permanently cold, platforms rimed with hoarfrost from the chilly aura of vast coolant towers. Others were always tropical hot and damp from the steaming output of chemical fractionators. Frequently, both extremes could be found within a few hundred yards of one another. Poverty was rife here. The legionary saw no souls who were not clothed in shabby, grimy cuts of worker garb, and their hollow faces and averted gazes spoke to him of people who were beaten down, who hung on by their fingertips. Unseen, he grimaced in the shadows of his hood. It seemed wrong that here, above the planet that was the bright heart of the Imperium, citizens had no taste of the glorious future the Emperor wanted for them all. Garrow pushed the thought away as he came upon what he was looking for, a village square, for want of a better term, a larger open space between two towering smokestacks that the locals had repurposed into a marketplace and meeting point. The legionary found a shaded perch above from which he could observe the area and scanned the milling crowd for his targets. The group were dressed no differently than those around them, but to a warrior's trained eye they stood out like magnesium flares on a dark night. A trio of earnest-looking men, two keeping watch, while the third carefully offered slips of paper to anyone who would take one. Garrow saw red ink on the paper, text he could not read from this distance, and the shapes of icon symbols to aid any illiterates to understand the leaflet's intent. He smiled thinly. The followers of the Lectitio Divinitatis were becoming bolder, and that would give him what he needed. Garrow planned to wait for them to finish their proselytizing and then track the men back to their point of origin. Somewhere amid this hissing, clanking mess of conduits there was a clandestine church. And if he found it... A low cry came to him, arresting his train of thought. Four more figures had emerged from the passers-by, rough types with the build of Imperial Army troopers about them, although none of the quartet wore anything approaching a uniform. The new arrivals were haranguing the believers, and Garrow speculated on what was happening below him from body language and the snatches of snarled words captured by his augmented hearing. The four were members of the group in charge of this part of Hesperides. Garrow had not seen a single Arbites officer since he arrived on the orbital plate, not even a monitor drone. He guessed that whichever member of the tech barony was charged with rule of Hesperides had little interest in the people who lived in between the air machines, as long as the processors kept working. In this kind of environment, thugs of a certain stripe flourished, where law enforcement was absent and weakness was rife. Demands were being made. From his vantage point, Garrow glimpsed the flash of silver from thrown coins as the larger of the thugs, a broad barrel of a man with a wild beard, pulled tribute from the hands of one of the believers. It clearly wasn't enough, because the thug produced a push sword from under his coat and ran through the man who had been holding the leaflets. It was a basic but efficient kill, up under the ribcage. The victim went down, dead before he hit the platform, the papers he had been clutching scattering like wind-blown leaves. There were shouts and screams, and the two remaining believers exploded into panicked motion, bolting through the crowd, heading towards rat runs on the western side of the marketplace. One of the thugs stayed behind to pick over the dead man's corpse, but the bearded killer led the other two on a chase. Garrow cursed silently. If these fools killed his only leads, he would be stymied. All the members of Keela's church would draw back and hide themselves, and the saint, if she was here, would be spirited away by nightfall. Moving as quickly as he could without drawing attention, Garrow went after them, leaping from one cluster of conduits to another. The terrain became increasingly difficult as his elevated path was blocked at random intervals by outcrops of machinery or shrieking steam grills. Twice he lost sight of the fleeing believers and the men in pursuit, but their shouts allowed him to zero in and keep them from vanishing into the complex root system of brassy tubes. The legionary heard the bass cough of a heavy-caliber gunshot and a wail of pain. Away from the crowds, the thugs were happy to start shooting, where collateral damage would be minimal. Garrow's enhanced senses smelled fresh blood, and plenty of it. The injured believer was bleeding badly. He managed to get ahead of the thugs, closing the distance to the running men below along a high maintenance walkway. Amid the constant background chorus of rattling apparatus and clanking vents, Garrow's heavy footfalls went unnoticed. Forced to a halt as the walkway came to a sudden dead end, he paused to take in the scene. 50 feet beneath him, the uninjured man was struggling to help his wounded comrade stagger forward, but the slick of blood that trailed behind them was enough for Garrow to know that one of them would be dead in minutes. That estimate fell to zero when the thugs emerged from a side passage, and the one with the gun put a second round into the bleeding man. The hydrostatic shock of the impact parted the two believers, sending the injured one over a safety rail and into oblivion. Garrow glimpsed the body spinning away towards the filthy clouds. The one with the beard shouted something about being owed more money, about promises made, and the dimensions of this sordid drama became full and clear to the legionary. The thugs ran this part of Hesperides' plate, and they were letting Keeler's followers have a safe haven here in return for hard currency. But belief alone was not enough to mint coin, and the greed of men like these had few limits. He imagined that no matter what they had been given, it would not have been enough. They were going to kill all three of the believers to send a message. What other reason was there to have committed brutal murder before so many eyes, if not to sow fear? For a brief moment, the War Master's snarling aspect rose and fell in Garrow's thoughts. He shook off the memory. Out came the push sword again, still red with the gore of the man it had killed. The last of the believers was looking back and forth between the killers and a narrow passage 10 yards away, asking himself if he could make it there before a bullet buried itself in his back. Garrow had seen enough. He stepped up and over the edge of the suspended walkway and dropped the distance to the deck below, hitting with the impact of a demolition hammer. The metal flooring flexed under the force of his arrival, putting the thugs and their would-be victim off their feet. The panicked believer was quick to recover, however, and scrambled away towards the gaping alley. He was so used to seeing that barely controlled terror on the faces of common humans that it struck him as odd to find it absent. Without his power armor, they must have thought Garrow was some kind of mutant affected by gigantism. It never occurred to them that he was a space marine. After all, why would one of the Emperor's angels of death ever come to this light-forsaken place, much less so without armor or fanfare?
"What are you?"
spat the one with the pistol, taking aim.
"Go, I freak."
The bearded man hesitated. Perhaps he had some clue about Garrow's actual origin, but his rat-faced cohorts were too snappish and blood-hungry to think twice about what they were facing.
"Yeah, him,"
bellowed the third member of the group, whose mouth was full of teeth filed to points, and whose flesh was a canvas for dozens of obscene electus.
"Piss off!"
Garrow took a step forward and met 4 bullets fired in quick succession by the gunman. The shots hit him in the chest and belly, breaking the outer layer of his epidermis, but penetrating no deeper. He grunted with irritation and reached into each of the wounds with thumb and forefinger, pulling out the flattened heads of the kinetic rounds and flicking them away. Blood, thick with gene-engineered Larriman cells, was already clotting the trivial wounds. The one with the gun was clearly an imbecile. Instead of putting distance between himself and Garrow, he came closer, aiming the heavy pistol up to target the legionary's head. Garrow stepped in to meet him. With a lazy backhand, he smacked away the weapon, shattering the bones in the gunman's forearm. He could have left it there, but there was a lesson to be taught, and so he put what he considered to be a light punch into the squealing gunman's chest. The blow caved in the thug's ribcage, collapsed his lungs, and stopped his heart. The man, covered in phosphor-glowing tattoos, cried out the dead man's name, and turned tail and fled back in the direction of the marketplace. The thug with the beard and the push sword yelled and slashed at the air before Garrow, attempting to force the legionary back with a wild, uncontrolled feint. He was trying to put Garrow on the back foot, perhaps so he could extend away and flee as well. The warrior watched the criminal's pattern, saw it, and in the next breath he grabbed the razor-sharp blade and yanked it forward. A seasoned swordsman would have let go of the handle, but the thug's best challengers had only been untrained civilians with no grasp of bladecraft, and he had no more moves to make. Ignoring the distant sting of pain as the push sword cut into his palm, Garrow twisted his wrist and disarmed the bearded thug, the motion breaking fingers in his opponent's hand. The blade fell to the deck, and he stamped on it, the steel heel of his bionic leg snapping it in two. Garrow reached out and grabbed the thug by the shoulder and squeezed, feeling bone grind on bone.
"You have made several mistakes," he told the man, as he listened to him panting.
and your path brings you to me.
Please, don't.
Garrow shook his head.
That time has passed.
He shook back the cuff of his robes and showed the man one of the sigils branded into his flesh, the device of a skull against a six-pointed star.
You attacked a legionary. Do you understand that?
The bearded man's eyes were wet and streaming. A patch of dark colour spread on his breeches as he soiled himself in fear.
I want to know where they are.
Garrow nodded in the direction that the surviving believer had gone.
You know. Tell me.
Don't know,
gasped the thug.
Don't remember.
You do,
Garrow corrected gently. He tapped the thug's forehead.
Memory chains in your brain tissue. Either you access them or I will.
What?
Garrow put his other hand around the man's skull and slowly began to apply pressure. He would need to be careful, to crack the bone without destroying the soft organ inside. The warrior took on a gentle, lecturing tone.
When the genesmiths made me what I am, they placed an implant in my belly called a priomna. A stomach within a stomach, if you will. It allows me to ingest poison and toxics, subsist on edible materials that would kill any other living thing.
A wet crackle sounded from beneath Garrow's fingers, and the thug cried out in terrible pain, fruitlessly trying to peel the legionary's grip apart.
Moreover, he went on,
as if this were instruction for some neophyte battle brother,
there is a second implant, the omophagia, capable of separating genetic memory from ingested matter, if you can conceive of that.
He leaned close and looked the thug in the eyes.
What I eat, he said, with cold clarity, I take the memories from. Do you understand?
The thug's cries became whimpers, and Garrow knew that he did.
One way or another, said the legionary as he increased the pressure. You will tell me where to find the hidden church.